or in the right place, and I know where I'm at, more or less. I've entitled this presentation this afternoon, The Door at the End of the Universe, and you're going to have to wait till the very end to figure out what I think the door at the end of the universe really is. But I want to start off with a different door. This would be probably the door at the beginning of the universe. What I want you to imagine is how you might get a universe in the first place, any kind of universe. Maybe you can't imagine that, neither can I. But there are obviously people who do imagine these things, and we call them cosmologists, and they're very smart people. It must be an interesting undertaking to come up with all of these incredible theories that are put out there in cosmology, when obviously you can never go back and actually check that, and so on. The bottom line is that while we may not know how to make a universe, we do know that the universe that we are in is a very special kind of universe. It is a universe in which life can exist. And that may not seem very impressive to you, but it really is a very special, special kind of universe. There are all of these constants in this universe, all these forces that have to be just exactly precisely right if life is to exist. For example, it used to be thought that maybe you could make life based on something other than carbon. Maybe you could make it based on some related chemical to come, some related kind of atom or element. But the more we study carbon and the other elements, it really looks like carbon is pretty special. It really works very nicely for making the kind of molecules that living things are made out of. So there's a good reason why we are carbon-based in our life here on Earth, because it's about the best thing you could imagine for making living things out of. But there are other things, things like gravity. Think about what it would be like if gravity was just a little bit stronger than it is right now. Of course, we'd all weigh more. But that really wouldn't be the problem. The problem would be things like our sun. You know, the sun is made out of mainly hydrogen and helium, and it is a gigantic fusion reactor. That's where all that energy is coming from, fusion reactions inside the sun. Basic idea is this. You have gravity, and gravity in the sun is causing all of those atoms that make up the sun to press down towards the center of the sun. That means there's terrific pressure in there, the kinds of pressures that you need for fusion reactions to occur. What would happen if the pressure was greater inside the sun than it is? Presumably, yes. The pressure would be greater, the rate of the reaction would be greater, so you'd have a lot more energy coming off of the sun, right? That would mean we couldn't live here on the Earth. It'd just be scorched. And of course, the Earth would go around the sun in a different kind of way because of the issues there with the way orbits work. It would be in a different kind of orbit. Maybe could you put it in an orbit that would be further out? Is there some way that you could balance it out? It doesn't really look like it. Bottom line is gravity happens to be just about right with things. So there are a number of variables in any kind of universe that you're going to make that have to be just about right. I'm going to sort of use as an analogy for getting those variables right the idea of a combination lock on this door that is going to let us through into a universe that will allow life to exist. And we really don't know much about what that combination lock is really going to, is even on it. We think we have some ideas about things like gravity and the weak force and electro, this, that, and the other thing, but we really don't know. It looks like there have to be several properties that have to be right for life to exist. We don't know probably quite how many, because some people say, well, actually, some of these forces are actually this different flavors of the same thing and stuff, but at least several have to be exactly right. So we might think of these properties as being like how many times you're going to turn the combination lock in one direction or the other. But there's something else that we really don't know, but we can guess at, and that is that the number of stops on that wheel. In high school when you had a locker and it had a combination on it and it went, up to 60 or something like that? It looks like there are lots of potential settings that you could have for each of these variables on this combination lock. And obviously, the more times that you turn the lock clockwise and then counterclockwise, the more difficult it is to crack, and the more numbers there are on the dial, the more difficult it is to crack. How do we crack this lock so that we can get into a universe that allows life to exist? Well, there are a number of theories that have been put out there about how you get around this kind of difficulty. One theory is this. You have this character. I don't know why he's French. I just thought he should be. He says, "Hi, my name is Chance Aléatoire," which basically means random chance in French. And Chance Aléatoire says, "I can easily crack this safe in a jillion years." Can he really do that? Can we somehow or other get a universe like this by random chance or something? Well, the problem is that no universe means that we have no matter to work with. There are no atoms. That would sort of seem to cramp your style a little bit, but it gets a little bit worse. There's no energy if you don't have a universe either, and there's no space even, and possibly even worst of all, there's no time. Time doesn't exist. It seems that ideas like chance only work when you've got things like matter and energy and time and space and so on. No universe really means nothing in a far more profound way than we're thinking of. It doesn't mean a vacuum. It means really, truly nothing, profoundly nothing. So, in short, there is no chance to work with. So Chance Aléatoire, he unfortunately is not going to be able to solve this thing. In addition to that, obviously if you don't have a universe, you don't have any laws to work with. So there aren't sort of laws that make universes or something. The laws that that this universe operates on are properties of this universe. They're not properties of something else. So, it looks like our life-friendly universe is impossible. It's impossible to make it if you're trying to get it through some sort of natural sort of way. But there is another way around this that has been proposed, and that other way is this. The Epicureans came up with it back long before the time of Christ. The idea that they had was that the universe is eternal and infinite. It's fascinating to read their stuff. Really interesting, deep thinkers about this. We live in an eternal and infinite universe. I was reading just not all that long ago, Titus Lucretius Carus. Usually he's just called Lucretius. In his book, De Rerum Natura, which just means on the nature of things. And he has this long discussion in there about how it's impossible that there is an edge to the universe because, and then he does a nice thought experiment. What would happen if you took a bow and arrow right to the very edge of the universe and you shot that arrow out? Well, there'd have to be space out there for the arrow to go into, right? So they have very sophisticated arguments. They thought about this very carefully. And many, many people thought that this was the way things are in ancient times and up until fairly recent times. However, you have not been taught that. If you've gone to high school, even maybe even in grade school, or if you watch the Discovery Channel or something, you know about Big Bang cosmology. Big Bang cosmology says that the universe began as an incredibly small, amazingly energetic sort of point in and expanded out into the universe that we see today. It is a very disturbing concept if you thought that the universe and everything was eternal. Because when you have a universe that sort of has a beginning to it, it's a little bit tricky, by the way, because obviously without time, the concept of beginning is kind of a bit tricky. And so there are some subtleties to this that you don't want to get too excited about. But the bottom line is, it essentially looks like if the universe isn't eternal, it must have had a cause. And if you look in very respectable scientific journals like Nature, for example, you go back into the early 1930s, as I recall, where they're discussing this sort of thing, and there are some very angry papers published in there. I'm trying to remember who it was who wrote that they wouldn't accept this no matter what, because just for philosophical reasons, they wouldn't accept that the universe could have a beginning because of all that implies. If something had to cause the universe, then everything isn't the cause of the universe. It, you know, can't be caused. There's an interesting thing about belief systems. It seems to me that most of them will ultimately appeal to something infinite. Obviously, Christians appeal to a God who is infinite in terms of time, and he's omniscient and omnipresent and all of those sorts of things. But if you're not a Christian, still, ultimately, these other systems come up with something that's infinite. And when you take away the infinite universe, obviously you're in trouble if that was what you were appealing to. Some people do something similar to this nowadays, and they talk about multiple universes, either the universe sort of appearing and then collapsing and then a new one, and eventually you luck out and get the right one. Or the multiverse idea, which is that you just have zillions of universes out there, which seems kind of like an oxymoron because universe by definition sort of seems to mean everything. And so you have multiple everythings, which is a bit strange. But, you know, these guys are physicists, so they're smarter than the rest of us. The problem with that is that then you have to have some way of making a lot of universes instead of making one, and I'm not sure that it really helps too much from my perspective. Anyway, this infinite idea is certainly out right now, and although there are some people who would love to see it come back. So because the universe looks like the kind of thing that had a beginning, there needs to be some other way of opening this door. to get us into the universe that we occupy. And it seems that a reasonable way of doing that would be to adopt a belief that's called deism. The idea that there is some sort of God out there who can at least open this combination lock for us. They may remain not involved with the universe or whatever, but at least they get the door open for us. That would be deism. It seems to be necessary to explain at least the existence of the universe as we know it. Interestingly enough, and I know that he would be furious and deny it because, I know this for a certainty because he did it. Richard Dawkins fairly recently claimed that deism actually was a respectable idea. not that he believes it, but that he could see that you could make a respectable argument for it. Ironically, when that was published, he immediately denied it and then sort of did a lot of squirreling around trying to get out of it. But I think there are a lot of people, even atheists, who would sort of at least admit that this may be not an unreasonable idea, deism. And at least it gets us into this special universe that we live in. Problem is, once you get a universe in which life can exist, there is another door to open if you want to get life. So we will call that safe door that we want to open there the life safe that we want to get open. So now it has a combination lock on it as well. The great thing is we have something to work with this. To open this door, we do have matter, energy, space, and time. Is that enough to get that door open? Yeah. Are they tools that can get the combination for us to get living things? Well, let's assume a few things. By the way, I should tell you, this is basically giving away the farm in the first place, but it's okay. I want you to see kind of how this sort of argument can work. So let's assume that we have a universe with a just right Earth. There's some debate about whether that is a reasonable assumption to make, because when we look at other planets, and it does look like there are other planets out there in the universe, they don't look like our Earth, so far at least. The ones that have been found don't look like the kind of place where life can exist. Our Earth is really kind of a special one, judging from the other planets out there. But let's assume we have a just right Earth, and let's assume that on this just right Earth we have abundant building block molecules to make big biological molecules like DNA and protein. Some people think that you might be able to get these from things like meteorites coming in and hitting the Earth, or from lightning in the atmosphere or something. You can get things like amino acids and so on. That's probably conceding a lot to say that that's a reasonable idea, but let's just say it is. Let's just assume that and look at things. We'll concentrate on the production of protein biological polymers. Remember that living things are made out of a number of polymers. There are polymers like proteins, which are basically made out of a bunch of amino acid molecules joined together. And then there are other polymers like DNA that are made out of nucleotides that are joined together, and these can be quite long. And there are some other macromolecules like triglycerides and this sort of thing. Yeah. But we'll just concentrate on polymers, on proteins. And by the way, these are meaningful and functional proteins that we're going to concentrate on. You can make proteins that actually are not particularly meaningful or functional. Just by randomly joining together amino acids, you can make basically gibberish proteins. You can do the same thing with the English language. Randomly join together letters of the alphabet and you'll get gibberish as well. But we'll assume, well, what we need to make living things are meaningful and functional proteins. Even proteins that have the correct amino acid sequence, by the way, can still not be particularly meaningful and functional, and you can do this experiment, but you can't be vegan. Just fry an egg. That protein in the albumin around the egg, all you have to do is heat it up, and it unravels. So it's not folded in the very specific way in which it needs to be folded to do its function, and then it sort of unravels and forms this sort of jumbled interlocking network of proteins that is the white in a fried egg. So anyway, proteins are really special things. They have to be just right in living things if you're going to have a living thing. This is how you make a protein. You take an amino acid, you bring in another amino acid, and you remove a water molecule. It's called a condensation reaction. These are common kinds of reactions that are done in chemistry labs. And if you bring in another amino acid, you can remove another water molecule. And if you bring in another, you can bring in another one. And you'll notice that these amino acids happen to spell out something meaningful. They don't have to. Okay? There's nothing about amino acids that say they have to spell out anything meaningful. But in you, the proteins that are made out of amino acids in you do spell out something meaningful, but it's meaningful in the protein language and not in English necessarily. So let's see here. If that's how you make proteins, how do you unmake a protein? Well, you do exactly the opposite. You have a water molecule come in and it splits the amino acids, and then you wind up with just amino acids and no longer proteins. Now, here is what I want you to think about. If you're not a chemistry major or taking chemistry in college right now, think back to high school when chemistry was your favorite class. In chemistry, one of the really sort of fundamental ideas is that chemical reactions go to equilibrium. So if you have two things that you're wanting to join together to make something else, what you do is you make the concentration of those two things high, and then they react with one another and form a product of whatever you're going for there. When you put amino acids into water, water is obviously in very high concentration, right? I mean, that's what you're dissolving the amino acids in. The amino acids are there in obviously far lower concentration. How do you think the chemical reaction is going to work to join those two amino acids together? Are water molecules going to be readily coming out of those situations? I mean, when there's tons and tons of water all around them? No, this isn't going to happen. That's not the way chemistry works. What you have to do if you're doing chemistry and you want to do this is to somehow or other create a situation where water isn't there in abundance, that water is rare. And then you can get these things to join up together nicely. Or it's much better to do some other tricks than to do it the way that nature normally does it in your body. So aqueous solutions are obviously not a great place for making proteins. In fact, they are a good place to break down proteins. Thankfully, proteins are very stable molecules, so don't worry. Yes, you are made out of, there's a lot of water in you, but you're not about to sort of get rid of all of your proteins, you know, sort of break them all down just with the water there. Most of the time, these reactions are sped up massively by other proteins that act as catalysts. But my bottom line is this. Even if you put a catalyst into water with amino acids, you still won't get proteins. They don't do it. This is not the way chemistry works. What you have in your body is a very special system that uses energy in this process of joining things together. Unless you have special machinery to do it, and you're feeding that machinery the energy to get the job done, you are simply not going to make proteins out of amino acids. It's just the opposite of what chemistry tells us. So, amino acids don't spontaneously polymerize into proteins. That just doesn't happen. We know that from chemistry. Even if they did, no natural mechanism has been found for joining monomers into meaningful sequences. This requires an intelligent cause. So the idea that somehow or other you have a warm little pond that's full of amino acids and you wait long enough and then something crawls out of the pond is not a really reasonable idea. Now, I don't want to be too dismissive here, because there are people who are working very hard all the time to try to come up with some sort of plausible scenario for how you might be able to get some kind of precursor to something resembling life in a situation where there isn't life. However, I've looked at a lot of these, and I really haven't seen any that come close to a situation that works. And it seems that pretty much all of them either involve chemists doing stuff in chemistry labs, which is not what we're talking about with the, you know, Earth without life, or they involve just flat-out denials of the laws of chemistry, the way in which chemistry works. An important question that you're probably wondering about is this. Why do cells need to make meaningful proteins? What's the need here? Why is that? Well, one of the major reasons is this. Life operates in a state of perpetual flux. Those of you who just ate lunch understand this. You take in energy, and you use that energy, and you also take in other nutrients as well, and your body continually consumes energy. What happens if you stop putting foods into yourself that will provide you with the energy that you need? You will grow progressively thinner, and then you will die. You must keep taking in matter and energy, or it's all over for you. Because life, chemical reactions go to equilibrium, except in living things. As long as you are alive, you are in a state of disequilibrium. It's in test tubes that things go to equilibrium. In you, they don't. If they do go to equilibrium, that's when you die. You will go to equilibrium then. Don't try this experiment at home. For life to exist, molecular machines are necessary to manage the flux of energy and chemicals through cells. And this is one that we looked at the other day. This is E. coli ATP synthase. It just happens to be one of those molecular machines that's involved. this particular one happens to be irreducibly complex. But that's really not the point that I want to make right now. The point I want to make is these are complicated machines and they're made out of protein. Those proteins have to be just right, just like the cylinders in your car's engine have to be just right. If they're too big or too small or square or triangular or something, they aren't going to work. They have to be just right, and that is why you need meaningful proteins in the same sense that you need meaningful cylinders in your car, or you're not going to be driving down the road. Science is about what is predicting what is likely to happen. You know, we're really impressed with people like Isaac Newton, because Newton was a prophet, and what he did was he made this prophecy. He said, "If I drop this pen, it will go down." And you know what? I've personally tried that experiment many times, and Newton has been right every time. Scientists do not say, you know what? If you drop that pen a trillion times, maybe once it will go up. That's not science. Science discovers laws, and those laws are about the same thing happening every time. Scientists are the most boring prophets there are, because all they do is prophesy the same thing over and over and over again. That's what science is about, predicting what is likely, not what is unlikely. Chemistry predicts that significant amino acid polymerization will not occur. It also predicts that random protein polymers will not be useful and will be harmful to life. In fact, if you were generating random protein polymers, they would most likely kill you. They'd just plug up the whole system. You'd become something like an egg white. And you know what? Egg whites that are being cooked don't make very good chickens. Materialistic origin of life scenarios predict what doesn't happen. And yet that is commonly presented as being somehow or other a more scientific view than other views that are out there. Why is it scientific? Well, it doesn't act like other science. It is scientific only because people who are committed to materialism tend to define science in terms of materialism. So it's basically only that way by definition, as opposed to because of some, in my opinion, reasonable way of looking at things. So there are only two known ways in which proteins are made. One of them is molecular factories inside your cells, and the other is in chemists' labs. They're not made naturally, sort of in other ways. And that's a good thing. So how do we get this door open? Well, maybe we need to go a little bit beyond that deistic God. The deistic God can't just step back and not be involved with the matter at all. We need a God to come in and do something with the matter, to at least spark our Frankenstein alive. God has to put the matter together in a specific way. Something outside of nature has to come in and work with nature to get living things. Sounds kind of like the God that is described in the Bible. Here in Genesis 2:7, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." So And here we've got this God who is taking matter, putting it together in a specific way, and doing some things that obviously, yeah, I can't tell you exactly what he did, because if I did, if I could, I'd be winning my Nobel Prize right now. And anyway, I'm trying not to say something about the president. I would have actually done something. Let's move on. Just because you have living things doesn't mean that you have novel living things. You know, one of the great things about the theory of evolution as Charles Darwin formulated it was that he proposed to have an answer for how you get new kinds of organisms, the origin of species, the origin of different kinds of organisms. How do we get novel new organisms, new organisms that we don't have already? Well, the example that I want to use involves yet another safe door, but it involves the color blue. You ever seen a blue rose? Yeah, I have. Yeah, I have. Here's why you haven't seen a blue rose. Selection can't make roses blue because roses lack blue genes. Okay? You know, you can't select something that isn't there. That's the problem. You can grow millions and millions and millions of roses and kill all of the ones that aren't blue and allow only the blue ones to live. Except that what that means is you will just kill all of your roses, because there won't even be any that are very blue at all. Now, there are roses out there that are sold as blue roses. I know, because I have one growing in my front garden. It's a very sad rose, I should say. I keep having to protect it from the yellow rose that grows in front of it that just grows very, very fast. But it's a nice one. I'll show you a photograph of it here in a minute. Selection can't select, however, what isn't there. It just can't do it. It'd be like me coming in here and saying, I am going to select you guys for 27-foot tall men. You know, there aren't genes in human beings that cause people to grow to 27 feet tall. It'd be a silly thing to do. It's just not the way it works. Making blue roses requires engineering the rose genome. And in fact, that is how genuinely blue roses have been made, by brilliant scientists in Australia who apparently had nothing better to do. What they did was they took a blue gene from an iris, and they put that into a rose. And guess what? It turned out not to be that simple. Then they had to engineer things so that the blue gene was turned on, and they had to turn off some other genes. And it was quite an involved process, but yes, they've got some blue roses in Australia. Real blue roses. There are other ways of making blue roses, however. Yes, you can just dye the roses blue. You've probably seen that done with carnations. You know, blue carnations, they don't grow blue. They're just stuck into blue food coloring, right? And they pull it up in there. Blue roses, blue carnations. Look, there is a huge market apparently out there. Somebody thinks there is for blue carnations. Why hasn't anybody made a blue carnation? Because you have to engineer it to get that kind of novelty in there. There's obviously, these Australians think that there is a great market for blue roses, genuinely blue ones. That's why they invested all that time and effort. This is the real blue rose that's growing in my front yard. I tried to actually make it as blue as it can look in the right light and with a little bit of help from Photoshop. It's not very blue, but it's bluer than other roses. And as I said, this is not the happiest rose in the world, but we love it anyway. Here is a blue rose, and that one was made using Photoshop completely. This is actually the yellow rose that grows right next door to the blue rose and keeps dominating it in various ways. Blue roses, these are ways in which you can get them. Engineering, genetic engineering is how you can get blue roses. Selection, whether it's artificial or natural selection, is not how you can get blue roses. My guess is that there have probably been, roses have been cultivated for probably thousands of years now. My guess is that for about as long as they've been cultivated, somebody's been trying to get a blue one. We know that selection doesn't do it, because if it did, we'd have them, and they'd be cheap. So, we've got this blue rose safe, and we need to get it open. It doesn't appear as if nature's capable of making new genes in organisms, like blue genes in roses. We just don't see that sort of thing happening. It may be that sometimes nature can take genes that are already there and change them in some way through random mutations or whatever. But actually making new genes, there are some genes, by the way, that people look at them and they say, aha, maybe that's how they got here, by some sort of random process. But we don't see it happening particularly. And certainly it would be convenient. By the way, probably every single one of you at lunchtime ate a genetically engineered organism, Roundup Ready soybeans. Why is it that they didn't just keep growing soybeans and spraying Roundup on them and waiting until they found one that lived when they sprayed Roundup on it? Because everybody knows that you're not going to get a Roundup Ready soybean using that method. The way you're going to do it is by taking a specific gene from an animal and sticking it into the soybean plant so that it can survive being sprayed with Roundup. And that's why Roundup Ready soybeans are loved so much by farmers. They can plant those soybeans, and then they can spray with Roundup, and lo and behold, they don't have to worry about other weeds, and the soybeans grow up, and they're beautiful, and they produce lots of soybeans, and then they can sell them for cheap, and then you buy them and you eat them. Or you eat the oil, or you eat the, all of these other things that we get from soybeans in this country. Obviously, if it was easier to do it, or even possible to do it, using natural selection or artificial selection, somebody would have done that, because who wants to eat genetically engineered stuff if you can get natural stuff that does the same thing? And it doesn't matter whether natural or artificial selection is used. It just doesn't get the job done. It looks as if getting unique, new kinds of things in organisms requires some sort of God working with individual kinds of organisms. And again, this is the kind of God that you see in the Genesis story in the Bible. And out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And it looks pretty obvious here that in this creation story that Adam had at least several of these things to name. I mean, he didn't say, okay, I'm going to call you guys mammals, and you guys the birds, all right, where is that woman I've been waiting for? It sounds like he spent some time naming things. Different kinds of animals that God created. Different kinds of organisms with these unique and novel traits that we see in the different kinds of animals. So here are some conclusions. Both creationists and materialists seem to converge on suspension of nature's laws to explain life. Ultimately, both invoke a miracle. The difference is that creationists simply admit it up front. The Bible, our experience of God's providence, and the creation all provide evidence of the existence of a God who plays an active role in his creation. And I know that theologically, in some quarters, this is not a popular idea nowadays. There are a lot of people, even Christians, who somehow or other deny divine action. And yet, it seems, at least in the Bible, that divine action in nature is something that is discussed fairly commonly. So, I haven't told you what the door at the end of the universe is. This is it. This is a door that's different from the other doors that we've looked at. There is no lock on the outside. There is no combination lock. There's no nothing that God is going to open for us. This is a door that we get to open or keep closed. It's up to us. The Bible says this about it. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and will sup with him and he with me. I hope that there are many of you today, in fact, all of you today, who won't hesitate to open that door to your heart and mind. Thank you.
We'd like to thank Dr. Stanich for being here today. I know many of you, many students who were at the part one session on Thursday might have some questions today. So now we want to open up the time here for some questions and answers. So for those of you who may have questions, please raise your hand and Dr. Stanich will answer.
Okay, you know what I tell people? I tell people I'm Australian, so that means I'll have an answer for everything. But yes, you've got to take it for what it's worth.
Thank you. Understood was an example or event in World War II when the bombs left their craters in England. They had new plants grow from those craters that had never been in existence in that area. I mean, there was some kind of change made from the heat and explosion or concussion that possibly change the genes, which doesn't explain where the genes came from to begin with, but there could be some phenomenon that is capable of creating new forms of life from certain conditions that they're...
I'm not familiar with that specific example. I do know that in England, for example, on what we would celebrate as Veterans Day, they have poppies, you know, that the veterans would have there. And those poppies, as I understand it, came from what occurred during the First World War. You know, poppies, at least there, only grow on disturbed ground. So where they had buried their dead, the poppies would grow up. And it's sort of a poignant reminder of that. I suspect that you're not talking about that sort of thing, though. There are a couple of things to keep in mind. First of all, yes, life is quite adaptable to different changed circumstances. And if there was some sort of changed environment that was being provided by those bomb craters. Possibly there were organisms that grew up there. There are also circumstances under which organisms can be changed in various ways, either because of, again, changing their environment, or because of combining together different sets of alleles for genes. You know, there are naturally occurring variations of genes out there that can be combined together in interesting ways. And ultimately, of course, yes, you can mutate things, but usually that doesn't have a particularly good outcome. So I'd love to see that that specific like a paper or something on that that would tell me. Yeah. If it happened. There's, you know, one of the great things. I mean, obviously you guys all know I'm a Christian, and you know, being a Christian isn't about denying reality or whatever. Stuff happens, it happens. That's interesting and wonderful and great to study.
Just quickly, I'm wondering if you can briefly explain the difference between the different levels of evolutionary thinking and creationism. What is the difference between theistic evolution and the gap theory and special creation and evolutionary?
Sure. I will do my best. I will tell you that I don't consider myself to be an expert on how you delineate between these things. And what I've noticed is that there are some people who... they consider themselves to be one thing, and then if you don't define it quite exactly perfectly their way, then you'll get into trouble. So if I inadvertently don't define your particular belief system as precisely as I should, please forgive me in advance. Probably at one extreme, you have the sort of atheistic, materialistic Darwinism that you see practiced by people like Richard Dawkins. And they attribute absolutely everything to random events, random things that happen, combined with natural selection. And that those two things acting together, sometimes it's called chance and necessity. Those two things without any outside intervention, no supernatural, no nothing, that would be sort of that extreme form of Darwinism out there. Then you have probably next in line would be something like deism, as I showed here, which says, yes, you know, to at least get the universe going and stuff, you probably need some kind of God or something. But once God got the universe running, then it was all these natural laws that he put into place and the time and so on that ultimately ended up with what we've got. Next along the continuum, at least in my mind, is theistic evolution. And I should tell you that theistic evolution, the idea of theistic evolution, seems to span a wide range of ideas. And it sort of blends into what I'm going to bookend it with. Theistic evolutionists believe that evolution was the mechanism that God used to create the situation that we see today. Death of the less fit things and this sort of this process was just God's way of doing stuff. Some are very adamant that the way God has done things is that is undetectable. So there's some sort of theological reason that they believe that. So, for example, anybody who's read, who is it, Douglas Adams, who wrote the let's see, The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. Yeah, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You remember that fish that went in their ears many years ago that I read at high school. I remember thinking it was very funny and brilliant at the time. The fish that proves there is no God, because only a God would make something that useful, and by definition, God, you know, can't be detected, so therefore there can be no God. Sort of an interesting idea, but yes, there are these people who believe that somehow or other, even though God used that process, he did so in such a way that he hid his action. So he sort of allow for divine action, but don't allow us to see it in any way. Then there are those who believe that God might have just fiddled a little bit with things along the way so that things progressed towards where we are. So there are some that, you know, sort of allow for divine action, but not in a big way. The interesting thing about these ideas is that instead of having one big miracle, they have a zillion smaller miracles basically going on. Some say that they are detectable, some say they're undetectable. Then that sort of grades into what I'd call progressive creationism. The idea that God sort of intervened every now and again during the history of the world. Sometimes you hear people called old age creationists, and they tend to sort of overlap with this idea that God maybe did one kind of creation, and that then prepared the way for the next kind of creation, which then prepared the way for the next one, and so on. Those of you who are familiar with Reasons to Believe, if you've ever heard of that organization, I don't want to be unfair. I don't want to unfairly represent them, but it seems to me that there's something along that line. Hugh Ross, who is one of the leaders there at Reasons to Believe, he sort of believes that the days of creation were these eons of time, and that each one sort of represents a time when God intervened or something. But then there might be some other interventions there. And by the way, I should tell you that I kind of tend to agree with Hugh Ross in some areas. I mean, he's very into the idea of divine action, and I obviously believe that divine action is a reasonable way of explaining what we've got. My disagreement with him is both in science and theology, but at least on those two ways, there's that. And so let's see, we've got the sort of progressive creation. And then you have what I think most people would call something like special creation. And that's the idea that God created the various different kinds of organisms that we see today. However, within that, there are also some interesting sort of gradations of ideas. There are some old earth creationists who might claim to be special creationists too, which is kind of interesting. Frequently, though, or most commonly, I think special creationists would be talking about a more recent creation. You know, not sort of that 3.8 billion years old or whatever it is that life is supposed to have first appeared on the earth or whatever. Then, you know, still within that, you have these, some people believe that the universe is very old and the earth is young. Sometimes that's called a gap theory. And a lot of the differentiation comes into questions about time. You may have heard of people who claim that there is no change at all in organisms. But frankly, I haven't encountered people who actually believe that, although I've encountered lots of arguments against them. So I don't know whether the people who are arguing against them are just sort of going against a straw man. I think that most special creationists would say, yes, God created certain types of organisms, and those organisms had the capacity to adapt themselves to various environments as they became available and so on. They'd argue, I'm kind of sympathetic to that idea because much of what you see that's actually selectable and might be subject to natural selection actually falls within the category of what's called quantitative genetics. This is the kind of genetics that's actually done by people like plant breeders and so on. Let's say you're trying to breed a new kind of corn, a new strain of corn that makes more oil because you want to make corn oil. Well, you can select corn to have higher and higher and higher oil content in the kernel, in the kernels. But there's obviously a point at which you can select until the cows come home and it won't make more oil. There's just a limit to how far you can go. There are nice sort of applications of, well, it's just an extension of classical genetics that's applied there. And obviously for economic reasons and so on, people want to know when they've hit that limit. It does seem like, oil content is something that selection could go for, and you can vary it around. Examples in human beings might be things like height. When a person's born, they have the genetic potential to grow to a certain height. I'm assuming that my genetic potential was similar to my father's and that his genetic potential was similar to his father. And yet, he was 3 inches taller than his father and I'm 3 inches taller than him. Why is that? Did I just sort of win the genetic lottery? Well, no, I can assure you that isn't the case when you have to get on a plane nowadays. But trust me, shortness is good. What it looks like is we were born with probably about the same kind of genetic potential to grow, but when I was born, there were certain advantages that I had. I was probably better fed than my father because he was raised during the Second World War and there were severe shortages. And I probably had better vaccines, so I didn't have some of those childhood diseases and so on. And so I've probably grown to something close to what my genetic potential is. So there are two things that decide sort of how tall I'm going to be. One is my genetic potential to grow tall. The other is my environment. But that genetic potential to grow tall is obviously different between different people because there are plenty of other people who had the same advantages in life as I had, but they didn't grow as tall as me. And then there are those ones who had the same advantages and they did grow taller than me. They had greater genetic potential to do that. Those kinds of traits that vary, like height, skin color is another one that varies around. I mean, look around this room. There's everything from kind of pink like me to quite dark brown and all every shade in between. Skin color is something that varies around. It can also be impacted by environment. Obviously, if you go out in the sun, I turn pinker. But if you're lucky, like my brother, he turns brown. It's not fair. Those sorts of traits obviously exist in living things and allow adaption to various environmental opportunities that creatures have available to them.
Well, I was curious about the blue rose. I had one in my garden I planted. My wife was a working person, so I said, I think they call it the working girl, the rose.
Oh, okay.
And I was just wondering, because they initially...
Tell me, does yours look like mine?
When it starts out, it's sort of pink.
Yeah.
And then I think with the exposure to the sun, it turns blue. So I was wondering, is that a gene spliced in there to do that, or
if you got the genuinely blue one, and I don't know whether they're commercially available yet, then basically, that's a gene that's been spliced into the rose genome, into the DNA of the rose. Most of what you buy that's called a blue rose is just one that's been selected to be as bluish as it can possibly be. Mm-hmm. There are sort of grayish ones, they're more sort of, apparently some of these, for those of you who are wanting to do some interesting chemistry, you can do this very easily at home. That's right, Trisha. You're a grade school teacher. You should do this with your kids. They'll enjoy it. You can take a lot of some plant pigments, and they actually vary around in color. They act as indicators to pH. So if you take red cabbage and you boil it, in water, the water will get that purple pigment in it. Well, if you change the pH of that water, you can get all kinds of colors, yellow, green, I think you can get a blue out of it too. So I suspect that in some of these, and one of the reasons why these roses don't grow quite as vigorously as others, that possibly what you're getting is a change in pH. You see this with morning glories, which I don't think you have growing around here. Do you do? Yeah. Have you noticed that there'll be one color at one time of day, and then sort of later on in the day they'll change to a different color? Yeah, hydrangeas, I think you can also change the pH, and you get either blue or pink. So I'm guessing that there's something approaching that going on with roses. And now that you brought it up, you know what? I think that, when I go home, I'm going to do that experiment. Because it's very easy to do. Get a bunch of roses, blue roses, dump them, boil them in water, and then see whether it acts as an indicator and whether it's bluer, and see whether it can truly be blue. Presumably, there's a limit to how much you can change the pH inside the petals of a rose and still have the thing. That may be part of the limit to it. But there are blue pigments in nature are actually a little bit unusual, but they do exist. And apparently, the blue one in irises is a real blue pigment. So that's why they use that. Yes.
Yeah. You're probably aware, just a couple short years ago, the Vatican made, I think in an encyclical, that there is within the Christian community room for evolution, the theory of evolution. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how they present that to the Christian world. And the second question, what do you think ultimately is their goal for making such a statement?
Yeah, I should tell you that I'm really not particularly equipped to address a question like that because I'm not a Catholic, and I don't know the Pope. but I will tell the one thing I'll tell you is I have a friend who is a Catholic, and a very interesting character. He's a convert to Catholicism, and a very enthusiastic sort of young earth creationist. He runs a Catholic organization called the Kolbe Center, K-O-L-B-E. And if you Google that, they have a website and so on. One day I was eating lunch with him. No, sorry, it was breakfast. That's right, we got together for breakfast. And I brought that subject up with him because the Pope had sort of made this statement that evolution is more than a theory, and so on. That was John Paul II, I believe. So I asked, how do you deal with that? And his response is all that I can give you, which was, he said, I believe that the Pope is God's prophet on earth, but that he has been misled by his advisors on that. One thing I do know about, you know, the Catholic Church has been really pummeled for many, many, many years over the what happened with Galileo. And the situation with Galileo was used by both proponents of the Enlightenment and also by Protestant apologists to go after the Catholic Church. Because of that, unfortunately, there was a lot of misinformation about that particular situation. And I don't think that I need to get into defending what the Catholic Church did. I think it was wrong. But at the same time, there are, let's put it this way, some mitigating circumstances there. But they're very sensitive to it. That's why they have an observatory, for example, in the Vatican, and so on. And unfortunately, the people who run the observatory there are very, very close-minded about Darwinism. It's interesting to hear some of my friends who are Catholics going back and forth about this, because apparently you have these Dominicans and they have one idea about it, and you have Jesuits who they say are basically, they say they're basically atheists. I'm not sure that the Jesuits would agree, but there's this tension in there. So what I would say is within Catholicism itself, there is a spectrum of beliefs on the creation exists, and those who are more traditional Catholics have a tendency to go off the tradition on this particular subject that has been passed down from the early church fathers, who were very clear about their belief about the creation. Yes.
I know science has turned to saving the planet sort of type of movement.
Yes.
And I was wondering how that developed and what's the stance that a creationist should have on that? Because I know you have some experience with environmental policy.
The last part of your question is the easiest part. It just beggars the imagination why Christians are not more involved with better stewardship of the creation. I can't understand it. I know that the usual explanation that is given is that you know, Jesus is coming soon, so who cares? You know, the Bible does say things like the Lord will destroy those who destroy the earth. I mean, I take that pretty seriously myself as a Christian. And you know, in the creation story, it talks about how man is given dominion over the rest of creation. Well, apparently some people want to take that as sort of a free rein to you know, do whatever they want. But that's clearly not what the Bible is talking about, at least in, from my perspective. Clearly it's meaning you have both authority and responsibility for what is going on here. So yes, if you're a Christian who doesn't believe that we should do what we can to take care of the creation, I'm sorry, we're in disagreement. Now, getting back to the first part of your question, which is how did all of this environmentalism come about? My guess is that there isn't one single simple answer there. Some of it clearly is a sort of reversion to paganism, the idea that the earth is our mother or something, and some of it might be because, you know, if you're a materialist, if you're an atheist, we're all there is, and therefore we're responsible for everything, and things could go wildly wrong, and there is no God sustaining the creation, which also is part of the Christian doctrine of creation. So, you know, that may explain to some degree why it seems like every few years there is some kind of scare. You know, oh man, you know, whoops, watch out, we might be destroyed by meteorites, or you know, global cooling is going to freeze us all to death, or global warming. And by the way, I'm not a global warming denier. I'm just saying, if it's true, it's very unfortunate that it fits in with this pattern of sort of Chicken Little behavior that many scientists, frankly, have lost their credibility in my mind over. So that's the best answer I can give you. Let's see, yes.
Dr. Standish, thank you for an excellent presentation. I have a question on carbon dating and its veracity. Would you talk about that a minute?
Sure. Let me give you again the disclaimer first. I'm a biologist, so I'm not a physicist, I'm not a geologist, or something like that. Let me just give you a little bit of background on carbon-14 and what it's about. The basic idea is this. All living things obviously have a lot of carbon in them because we're a carbon-based life form, and it seems like about the only kind of life form there is out there. In the atmosphere, there is carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide, a very, very small proportion of it, is made out of carbon that has two extra neutrons in its nucleus. So it's a little bit heavier. So that's called carbon-14, whereas normal carbon is carbon-12. That's the most common isotope of carbon, carbon-12. And the thing about carbon-14 is it is an unstable isotope. What that means is it only, if you have, let's say, 100 carbon-14 atoms, over a period of time, they will all break down into something else. What they break down into is not carbon-12, interestingly enough. They break down into nitrogen-14, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. But so here's the thing. Plants out there, the sun's shining on them, they're doing photosynthesis. In photosynthesis, they take the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and they stick it onto, they make biological molecules out of it, sugar, basically. We eat the plants. Now, we might eat the animals that eat the plants, or we just eat the plants directly. But those plants have in them carbon-14 from the atmosphere. So then we have that carbon-14 in us, in approximately the same concentration as the atmosphere has it. And then that carbon-14 starts breaking down. It turns out that over the course of something like 5,600 or 700 years, somewhere in there, half the carbon-14 in a sample of carbon will break down. And if you go another 5,600 or 700 years, another half, the half of what's left will break down. This is called the half-life of carbon-14. So here's the thing. If you can find something with carbon in it, something, some animal part or some plant part, like a piece of wood or something, and you can measure the carbon-14 in it, if, let's say, there's a quarter the carbon-14 that is in the atmosphere, what that should mean is that two half-lives have occurred, so it would be about something a little over 11,000 years old. That's the thinking. Now, because carbon-14 is in very low quantities in the atmosphere, it doesn't take very many half-lives for carbon-14 to all be gone in a sample. You're down to nothing, because you can't have half of a carbon-14 atom in a sample. There's, you know, atoms, they don't work that way. So generally speaking, I don't know of anybody who would disagree that you just can't go beyond 100,000 years with carbon-14 dating. Anything that is dated with carbon-14, if it's going to work, has to be less than 100,000 years. People used to say